best of all, you don't.
News headlines for Wednesday, February 25th. Manatee County Commissioner Carol Ann Phelps has died at age 68. The county officially confirmed her passing late yesterday. No cause of death has been established as of Tuesday afternoon. Phelps was elected in 2024 in an upset victory running a grassroots campaign against a well-funded Republican opponent. Since her election, she focused on controlling development, building infrastructure, and protecting rural communities. Before taking office, she was a frequent presence at commission meetings, known for reading agenda materials closely, speaking during public comment on rezonings and growth management, and occasionally scolding commissioners. Commentators say she modeled civic engagement, urging residents to show up, pay attention, and participate in local government. Funeral arrangements have not yet been announced. Development issues she often spoke about remain front and center in Manatee County. The Manatee County Commission last week voted to extend the conditional use permit for Mosaic. In a 5-2 vote, they allowed phosphate mining operations near the Manatee-Hardy County line for another 14 years, while expanding the mining area by more than 1,100 acres. The commission vote came even though the County Planning Commission recommended rejection of Mosaic's proposal. Supporters say phosphate remains a key part of Florida's agricultural economy and supports regional jobs. Opponents raised environmental concerns, particularly regarding groundwater pollution and how to reclaim the land subject to open pit mining. In a separate vote, commissioners rejected a large-scale development proposal. At a land use meeting last week, Manatee County officials denied a proposal for 2,000 home development in Parrish. Commissioners cited concerns about traffic congestion, infrastructure capacity, and compatibility with surrounding rural areas. The vote reflects ongoing debate about how quickly Manatee County should grow and whether roads, schools, and utilities can keep pace. The developer, National Home Builder Lennar, may revise and resubmit the proposal at a later date. Until next time, stay informed, stay rooted, and move with purpose. This has been Stephanie Coachman with your WSLR News.
Good morning. Welcome to the Peace and Justice Report right here on your own community radio station, WSLR 96.5 LPFM. In Sarasota and WBPBE 100.1 LPFM in Bradenton. And my name is Bob Connors, and I definitely would like to let you know that the opinions you hear today are strictly those of the host and the guests and do not necessarily reflect those of the management team, the board of directors, or any of the volunteers affiliated with the station. So, David, I have a special guest who I'm going to get on the line in about 10 minutes, and I'm going to read a brief bio of our guest now, so when I get him on the line, we won't have to spend time at that point. It's such a long bio, I wanted to read it before I get him. But his name is John McAuliffe, and he's been in the peace and justice movement since the 1960s. He worked with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, including voter registration, during the Mississippi Summer Project of 1964. He then served as a Peace Corps volunteer in Peru. He was a leader in the Vietnam anti-war movement, heading the Committee of Returned Volunteers and directing the Indochina program in the Peace Education Division of the American Friends Service Committee, the Quaker organization. He arrived in Hanoi on the day the war ended in 1975 and spent the next 20 years working for normal relations and to address the consequences of war, founding the Fund for Reconciliation and Development in 1985. After normalization of relations was achieved with Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, he focused on the same goal with Cuba. So that's exactly what we're going to be talking about with him today. What's happening in Cuba, how he views the situation, and some of the work he's done in Cuba over the last 20, 25 years. But before that, I'd like to let you know that support for WSLR comes from listeners like you and from Manatee Spirit Holistic Sound Studio, offering sound-based wellness experiences in Bradenton. More information is available at 941-201-0069 or info@manateespirit.com. And while I'm getting the guest on the line, I'd like to play an audio here. And it's by someone who, well, let me read a little bit about Michael Parente. Michael Parente was an American political scientist, academic historian, and cultural critic who wrote on scholarly and popular subjects. He taught at universities and also ran for political office. He is well known for his Marxist writings and lectures and was an intellectual of the American left. And he just passed away probably, he actually died on January 24th, 1 month ago yesterday, on January 24th. And if you listen to Democracy Now!, they did a couple of segments on Michael Parente after he passed away. And did I mention that David Young is here helping me on the control board to make sure we go out and we're heard loud and clear today? So thanks, David, for being here. Of course, David has a Monday morning music show from 7 to 9, The Sweet Spot. It's a great, great music, Americana, indie, blues, a little bit of everything. So thank you, David. And
morning, Bob.
And I wanted to say one more thing relating to Michael Parente. About 20 years ago, David Beaton, Arlene Sweeting, the co-founders of WSLR, helped bring Michael Parente to Sarasota. And this was 20 years ago. He spoke at New College. And after his talk, Arlene came over to me and said, "Would you mind giving Michael a ride back to Fogartyville and Bradenton?" And he's staying in our bedroom upstairs. So I had the pleasure of driving Michael Parente back to Fogartyville. So that was about 20 years ago after his talk at New College. So without further ado, I'm going to play this audio of Michael Parente. And the title of the audio is "The Power of Literacy." So thank you, David. See if we can get that to come through.
Tradition, history, it's had a very unluxurious history. It's had a very difficult, terrible, horrendous history. So we couldn't use it as a model. We have a different level of prosperity. What I would say is this. You could look at any existing socialist country. If you don't want to call them socialists, call them whatever you want. Post-capitalist, whatever. I don't care. Call it. Call them camels, window shades. Doesn't matter. As long as we know the countries we're talking about, you can look at any one of those countries and you can evaluate them in several ways. One, comparing them to what they had before. And that to me is what's very compelling. That's what's so compelling about Cuba, for instance. When I was in Cuba, I was up in the Escambray, which is like the Appalachia of Cuba, very rugged mountains, the poor people, very poor if they were. And I said to this campesino, I said, "Do you like Fidel?" And he says, si, with all our souls. I remember his gesture, with all our souls. I said, "Why?" And he pointed to this clinic right up there on the hill, which we had visited. He said, "Look at that." He said, "Before the revolution, we never saw a doctor. If someone was seriously ill, it would take 20 people to carry that person, because you'd go day and night. It would take 2 days to get to the hospital. First, because it was far away, and second, because you couldn't go straight. You couldn't cross the latifundio lands. The boss would kill you, so you had to go like this. And often when we got to the hospital, the person might be dead by the time we got there. Now we have this clinic up here with a full-time doctor. And today, a doctor in Cuba, when you become a doctor, you've got to spend 2 years out in the country. That's your dedication to the people. And a dentist who comes one day a week. And for more serious things, we're not more than 20 minutes away from a larger hospital. That's in the Escambray. So that's freedom. We're freer today. We have more life. And I talked to a guy in Havana who says to me, before, all I used to see here in Havana, you call this drab and dull. We see it as a cleaner city. It's true. You got up, the paint is peeling off the walls, but you don't see kids begging in the streets anymore. And you don't see prostitutes. Always that was prostitutes. Prostitution used to be one of the biggest industries. And today, this man is going to night school. He said, I can read. I can read. Do you know what it means to be able to read? Do you know what it means to be able not to read? I remember when I gave my book to my father, I dedicated a book of mine, Power and the Powerless, to my father. I said, to my father with my love. Gave him a copy of the book. He opened it up, looked at that. He only gone to the seventh grade. He was a son of an immigrant, working class Italian, and he opens the book and he starts looking through it and he gets misty-eyed, very misty-eyed. And I thought it's because he was so touched that his son had dedicated a book to him. That wasn't the reason. He looks up to me and says, I can't read this, kid. I said, that's okay, Dad, neither can the students. I mean, that's not something, I mean, don't worry about that. I wrote it for you. I mean, it's your book and you don't have to read it. You know, it's a very complicated book, an academic book. I can't read this book. And he just, and the defeat that that man felt, that's what illiteracy is about. That's what the joy of literacy programs is. That's why in Nicaragua you got people walking proud now for the first time. They were animals before. They weren't allowed to read. They weren't taught to read. So you compare a country to what it came from with all its imperfections, and those who demand instant perfection. The day after the revolution, they get up and say, are there civil liberties for the fascists? Are they going to be allowed to have their newspapers and their radio program? Are they going to be able to keep all their farms? The passion that some of our liberals feel, the day after the revolution, the passion and concern they feel for the fascists, the civil rights and civil liberties of those fascists who were dumping and destroying and murdering people before. Now the revolution has got to be perfect. It's got to be flawless. Well, that isn't my criteria. My criteria is what happens to those people who couldn't read. What happens to those babies that couldn't eat, that died of hunger? And there, that's why I support revolution. The revolution that feeds the children gets my support. Not blindly, not unqualifiedly. And the Reaganite government that tries to stop that kind of process, that tries to keep those people in poverty and illiteracy and hunger, that gets my undiluted animosity and opposition. So that's my answer to you. Let's not judge these countries by some abstract model, but where they're coming from. So you can judge a socialist country, one, by what it's replacing. Two, you can judge it by comparing it to U.S. society, and there, in some areas, you know, there's more, a higher level of production of goods and prosperity here, although it's very unequally distributed. The poor are the fastest growing social group in America, from 24 to 35 million. That's growth since 1980. And three, you can judge a socialist country by an abstract model of what you might ultimately want. By the way, that's not illegitimate. I shouldn't have said don't impose that. That's a reasonable thing to do in a certain way. Not to damn the country and to be holier than thou, but to say that there are aspirations, there are new forms of social relations we hope we can move to someday. There are places the Nicaraguans may go if they don't have to give half of their income to their army to fight off the Contras. There's new improvements, new cultural forms, new political forms that might develop. In fact, it's fascinating in Nicaragua that there are those new political forms. So I would judge that way. And I would say that what we would do is look at socialist countries and look at the things about them that might be indeed very admirable and learn about them. The ignorance about existing socialism is abysmal on the left, too. Learn about the People's Control Commissions in the Soviet Union, how they work. Learn about the ombudsman role of the press there. Learn about the function of trade unions. William Wimpensinger, president of the International Association of Machinists, comes back and he says, what clout Soviet trade unions have. Well, I was astonished because I had always heard they were just rubber stamps and didn't do anything. And he said, wow, what a role they play in production, in planning, in protecting the rights of workers. If we had that kind of clout, boy, this would be, we could really get results in our system. So there are a lot of things that are worthwhile, which we should learn about, which might be helpful to us as a historical experience that might be useful to us. And also look at the things we don't like and say, no, we don't want that. That would be my approach. Anybody else?
That was Michael Parenti talking about the power of literacy. And I have my guest on the line right now, John McAuliffe. John, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you for setting this up.
John, are you there?
I'm here. Do you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yeah, John, we can hear you.
Okay.
All right, John. Yes, go ahead. Get John.
I'm here.
John, apologize. We're having a problem with Bob's headphones. Thanks for joining us this morning. It'll be just a second, but okay. Good morning. And it is cold in Florida this morning.
I'd offer to sing, but it would be an insult to your listeners.
Hello, John.
Welcome. Yes.
John, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Can you hear me? Let me see. Let's go ahead and put that song on I had lined up over there in the CD player, David, and we'll figure out what's going on here.
Say yes. Say yes. Ah, yes, say yes, say yes, 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 yes. Life is a dance, anywhere you look at it, all of our life is a dance. Choose your own partner and pick the best song. Come now and join. Dance. Taking what comes and giving your all. There are rewards for this. And what I become is in my command. I am whatever I wish. Say yes. Say yes. Say yes. I am. Say yes.
Oh, yeah, that's fine. That's fine. Hello. Hello, John. Okay. Let's see if I can hear you now, John. I'm not on.
Hello,
I'm on.
Can you hear me?
I can barely hear you. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Am I coming through okay over there, David? Am I coming through? Yeah. All right. Well, I just want to make sure since I had read your bio a little while ago, John, I want to make sure that, okay. All right, why don't you say a couple of words, John? We'll see if we can be heard.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
okay.
Great. That's great. So, John, tell us about your work with Cuba over the last many years. I had read your bio, talked about spending 20 years working for normal relationships as far as what happened with the U.S. and Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos, and then you transferred your expertise and focus on the same goal with Cuba. So tell us how that all came about in the time frame that you've been working with Cuba now over the last, 20 years or so?
Well, it's almost 30 years.
30 years, okay.
Ironically, it's longer than it took us to get to normalization.
Wow.
With Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, despite the number of Americans who died and were wounded in that war and the deep antipathies that existed between the two countries in 75, we now have an extraordinarily positive relationship with Vietnam, and Vietnam is extraordinarily successful in its economic development. And
they're a communist country.
They certainly are. They're the same
that's
one-party system. Regrettably, they do control opposition people who get too aggressive on the internet, while there's a lot of individual freedom and a lot of mobility for people, you cannot organize hostile to the government demonstrations in Vietnam. You find yourself in the clink. You can organize demonstrations, labor demonstrations, and environmental demonstrations, but there are lines as to what's permitted. So it's I think a more open electoral system than the Cuban one, but it's still a system that guarantees that the Communist Party stays in control. So there is objectively, in terms of the ostensible criteria for human rights and democracy, there's no particular advantage the Vietnamese have over the Cubans, but they do have the advantage of a economic system that is much better for their own people and is much more acceptable to the U.S. In fact, we're their biggest export market or a major investor. Vietnamese Americans have become an integral part of life in Vietnam and back and forth constantly, culturally and economically. So, Vietnam, we now have a strategic partnership because of our shared concern about China. That's what the U.S. and Cuba lack. We need a common enemy, but it's the contrast both within the country and the contrast in the relationship with the U.S. is dramatic and, I think, unnecessary and irrational. But that's, I assume, what we'll go into.
Yes. I know when I've been on the internet quite a bit the last few days, looking at some of listening to people talking about Cuba, and, of course, say, hey, wait a minute, Vietnam is communist. Look at how successful things are going between the U.S. and Vietnam. And 67 years, the blockade with Cuba. Why can't relations be normalized with Cuba? I know during the Obama administration, things seemed to be coming along, but can you talk about that?
Yeah, we have a paper on our blog by Lou Perez, who is a professor at the University of North Carolina and probably the outstanding historian about U.S.-Cuba relations and Cuba itself. And he, I forget the exact title, but it's a paper that he wrote before Obama normalized relations. And he talks about the peculiar history between the U.S. and Cuba, which goes back to Thomas Jefferson and the early days of independence, and in which the U.S. just assumed that Cuba was a natural part of our territory. We were only prepared to tolerate Spain when the situation was stable, but when it became unstable, we were not prepared to let anybody else get in. And so that was part of the motivation of why we went in and intervened ostensibly on the side of the Cubans. But in fact, it was to establish our own dominance in Cuba, which we did legally and militarily and economically, which lasted until the Cuban Revolution. So essentially we have this, I think small countries on the side of big countries always have a problem. Ukraine has it obviously with Russia, the Vietnamese have it with China, Cuba has it with us. And it's a complicated balancing process to maintain national sovereignty and integrity, but yet make the big power at least tolerate you. The Vietnamese have done it for 3,000 years with China. The Cubans have been trying for 300 years with the U.S., and the balance has not been easy for them to achieve. They went to total control from the early 20th century to the revolution, total control by the U.S., and then reversed it completely and allied themselves with Russia and then China, just as the Vietnamese allied themselves with us for protection against China. So there's a whole, and you know, the question on Cuba is they've been very unwilling to follow, though they admire the Vietnamese tremendously, and the Vietnamese have provided them both a lot of investment and trade. They don't, first of all, the Vietnamese won't give direct advice, but the implicit advice of Vietnam is that Cuba should have gone to the kind of market economy with socialist characteristics that Vietnam has, and it could have developed economically. The Vietnamese did their big reforms in 1986, and there was a U.S. embargo against them at that point that had quite a lot of impact. But they made the decision that they needed to change their economy, and they successfully did it in 86, and it wasn't until 95 that the U.S. normalized relations and Clinton ended the embargo. But Clinton had the advantage of being able to end the embargo on his own authority, and actually did it a half a year before he moved to normalize relations, so that obstacle was gone. Obama did not have the legal authority to end the embargo because of congressional legislation, and so it, while he did a lot of things, a lot of very important things, he and Raul Castro really opened the door to the benefit of both countries. When Trump came in, he didn't initially reverse things, but by his second year, he basically reversed all of the major accomplishments of Obama, stopped cruises, made travel much more difficult, and made the whole business relationship much more convoluted. So there's there's a history with problems in both countries of fear and ideology and self-interest, bureaucratic self-interest in both countries that makes it very hard to move ahead. And Biden did very little to reverse Trump, unfortunately. He made a few gestures, but he didn't go back to what Obama's policy had been in by any means. And of course, when Trump came back in, even Biden's, at the very last minute, Biden took Cuba off the list of state sponsors of terrorism, which has important economic consequences. And then Trump was in for a few days and he put them right back on. But that's also Biden's fault. Biden should have done it the first days of getting into office. And then there would have been 4 years of restoring the relationship. But for a variety of internal Biden administration reasons, they just didn't do it. So Trump has made it harder now, especially in the last few weeks, by essentially creating a blockade of oil with absolutely no legal legitimacy, either in U.S. law or in international law. And so the Cubans are in very bad shape right now.
I think I had just seen last day or two that Russia's sending oil to Cuba right now.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, it's a funny reverse of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Who knows the conversations between Putin and Trump, but on the surface of it, it looks like Putin is defying the U.S. blockade. And does that mean that the U.S. Navy will seize Russian ships, Russian oil tankers? If so, what's the implication of that? Or will they all back off? It's a crazy situation that Trump has created at this point, that he's, as I say, without any legal authority, either domestically or internationally. He has, for political reasons, said that no oil shall go to Cuba. And Cuba was already in very serious problems with its economy and its electrical system, but now it's in a total crisis if it can't get oil. And Trump has stopped the Mexicans from doing it. He stopped the Venezuelans from doing it. We'll see what happens with the Russians. I mean, my fantasy is that there gets to be an agreement between Putin and Trump in which Trump allows Cuba its independence and respects its sovereignty and takes off the embargo, and Putin stops his invasion of Ukraine and allows it its independence. But that's fantasy, that they would make that kind of grand compromise, since both have their own reasons for wanting to control their neighbor.
You're listening to the Peace and Justice Report right here on your own community radio station, and I'm talking with John McAuliffe, who has been active in the Peace and Justice movement since the 1960s. He's been working with Cuba in terms of helping to normalize relations, just like he did with Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia back in the 70s and 80s. So, do you have any thoughts around Marco Rubio and what a key individual he has been in this Venezuela and Cuba situation?
Well, Rubio's whole political career was built on antipathy to the Cuban Revolution. it wasn't from any personal experience. He was born in the U.S. and his parents migrated to the U.S. before the Cuban Revolution. So there's no direct personal harm that was done to him or his family. But that's where he raised his money, and that's what his political base was in Florida, is the right-wing Cuban-Americans. Now, the interesting question is, Rubio is out of Florida politics now. His entire future depends on his relationship with Trump and continuing as Secretary of State, and his obvious ambitions to succeed Trump, and the competition with Vance and probably other Republicans. The intriguing question right now, which may also sound like a fantasy, is whether Trump is prepared to do a deal with Cuba and whether the Cubans are prepared to do a deal with him. You can look at the Venezuela situation, in which the U.S. decapitated by kidnapping the president and first lady of Venezuela, and, you know, it killed 100 or so people, including 32 Cuban security people that were protecting Maduro. But, you know, it was an in-and-out removal of the head of state, but essentially the U.S. has left in place the party structures, the government system, and everything else in Venezuela. And we still don't know. The Venezuelans say things that they are going to supply oil to Cuba, and we're seeing conflicting reports about whether the Cuban teachers and doctors are leaving Venezuela. But there, one can look at the Venezuela model and say, okay, the U.S. wanted to deal with the economic question of the U.S. oil interests in Venezuela. That's also to the interest of the Venezuelans, at least in the short term, because their system had fallen apart, the production system, the effects of Chavez and Maduro had devastated the oil production system. So from Venezuela's view, it's not a bad thing to get new U.S. investment and to get the technical skills of U.S. oil companies, and also to find a way around the export controls, the embargo that the U.S. had imposed on Venezuelan oil sales. Now, is there an analogy with Cuba? I don't know. Some people think there are. There is that Trump could say tomorrow, we've made a deal with the Cubans and the Cubans are going to open up the economy and there will be U.S. investment and they'll follow the Vietnamese model of the market economy with socialist characteristics. And because of that, I'm going to bring about the end of the embargo. And he'd have to do that for there to be U.S. investment. Now, that would be welcomed probably by almost all Cubans except the hardest core party people. It would be done with some nervousness about the ultimate U.S. goals and whether they would be able to withstand the more open involvement of Cuban-American money in Florida coming back. But it would probably be the only way of getting out of the embargo. And say most Cuban economists, certainly people all over the country, think that the current Cuban economy is a disaster. The state controls the intervention in the agricultural system. All of those things need to be ended so that they can get to the point of, they've begun to free up some things. At this point, there's more private import from the U.S. than there is state import, and foodstuffs and other things. So you have this active private sector that's doing small-scale enterprises of selling things in Cuba, but there's still big limits about private initiatives in the productive sector, in agriculture or in industry. So that needs to get changed, and most Cubans want to do it, except for this very... The party hasn't been able to resolve the situation. They moved it to, when Raul first came to power, there were serious steps towards market economics, and Raul condemned the idea that being socialist meant that you couldn't have private barbers. And Raul also, for the first time, allowed people to have private computers, allowed them to sell and buy cars and houses, had even to have cell phones was a reform that Raul brought about, and made a tremendous change in Cuba. But then they, after Obama, I mean, some of the people in the Cuban party were afraid of Obama and saw him as a Trojan horse, that he was, Obama was very popular in Cuba. He, in fact, looked more like many Cubans than the Cuban leadership did as an African-American. There were Cubans who were, including Fidel, who were very nervous about what Obama was bringing. And they did some tightening, but on the whole, it's been a false story that things were worse after Obama. They weren't worse politically or in terms of human rights or civil liberties. They were much better, and the economy and people's sense of confidence was much higher. But then Trump came in, and the defensive crouch started in, whether paranoia or legitimate self-defense, you'd have to judge. But then that led to a situation, and COVID led to a situation of these mass protests in 2021, and then a fairly heavy repression of them, which led to Biden's already disinclination to move became totally frozen. Until, you know, in most things, he did some things. He allowed remittances, and he allowed regional flights again, which were important, but he still didn't go to the main issues of restoring Obama. I started to say that there is a thesis that we could wake up tomorrow and hear an announcement that some accommodation has been made, and Trump will claim a great victory of doing what many Cubans wanted to already do, which is introduce market economy questions and open up the tourism sector to foreign investment. And, you know, there's a big hotel that was built by the Cubans right on what's called La Rampa, Fifth Avenue. It's the tallest building in Havana, violates all of the urban planning constraints, was built by Gaesa, which is a military controlled holding company, and it's almost empty. Perfect place to put a Trump sign with a Trump lease or purchase of that building. If that were part of the embargo, there are worse things. I mean, the Vietnamese had to gave the Trump Corporation a opportunity to put in a resort and golf course that, if you look in the New York Times, you'll see a story about how the Vietnamese violated all of their planning protocols and licensing restraints in order to accommodate this Trump investment, because they wanted to protect their exports to the United States. They needed to deal with the fear of what Trump's tariffs were going to do. So, you know, countries have to come to terms with each, with power, especially with power right next to them. And the Cubans have not done a very good job at figuring out how the control and feeding of the United States, which the Vietnamese have done very well with China.
So do you, I know, I read in a couple of videos that I watched that they emphasized the fact that they felt that Rubio was lying to Trump, that the negotiations and talks were not going on. And it said that Rubio was meeting with Castro's grandson. Do you think Rubio's actually been talking to Cuba? And
I have no idea. The more interesting story was that Alejandro Castro had met with U.S. representatives in Mexico. Alejandro is a generation older than the grandson and was the principal negotiator with Ben Rhodes for the normalization process. If he's in play and representing the Castro family, then that's an interesting possibility, because it means that sectors of the historic leadership are looking for a way out. Rubio's situation is that when Trump says jump, he has to say how high. And he could be, I've seen that story that he's just making believe that he's negotiating. But I don't think that Trump is, unless he's really out of it, and you don't know from the press accounts how much that's the case. But assuming Trump is still in control of his own administration and his own facilities, then I think Rubio plays whatever games he wants to play, but Trump will have his own channels of communication. Remember, Alejandro and Ben did months and months of negotiation, and nobody knew it was going on. The State Department didn't know it was going on. The media didn't know it was going on. It was, it came as a shock, a very pleasant shock, but a shock to every Cuba expert in the United States. They, and every journalist covering Cuba. So you just have to assume that if there were something real, we wouldn't know about it until Trump says, has a press conference and, or inadvertently says something about it.
So I know you'd mentioned the website earlier. Is there a website for the Fund of Reconciliation and Development?
Well, there is. It's www.ffrd.org. It's not, frankly, a very good website. We're very understaffed and underfunded at this point. So there, we do have a blog, and I can't quote you the access point, but that blog is where we put everything that's interesting from coming from within Cuba and within U.S. politics. People can always write to me, which is jmcauliffe@gmail.com, or no, let's do it easier, director@ffrd.org.
So it's ffrd.
.org, yeah.
Okay, ffrd.org.
Yeah, and then I will, it can either be Jay McAuliffe or director@ffrd.org, but director is easier to remember.
So you know, when you watch some of these videos and you read the YouTube comments, so many people, well, it's like a 50-50 split, that there are Cubans saying, how could things be any worse, and things should have changed a long time ago, and we need help. You know, and others will say, hey, please keep the United States out. Why are they destroying what we have here? I mean, how do the Cuban people view what's happening?
Well, 20% of the population has left Cuba in the last couple of years. I mean, that's just out. I mean, it's like Venezuela, the number of people who have left. and it's many more than left during earlier stages of the revolution. Younger people, educated people. I mean, it's a very different population than left 50 years ago. And they're angry and disappointed, but they're angry and disappointed at the bureaucracy and the rigidity and the fact that they felt forced to leave by the collapsing economy. But, you know, I have four friends who were in their 30s to early 40s who came during that period of, under Biden, when it was easy to just come across the border. And anybody who knows, well, I mean, there's divisions. There's some Americans who are friends of Cuba who are total solidarity and total support for whatever position the government takes. And there are other Americans who are totally antagonistic ideologically and because of the uppityness of the Cubans that they need to be put in their place. So you find in the American political ferment, you find a lot of different positions and analyses. And among Cubans, Cuban Americans, you find a lot of different positions. Amongst Cubans within Cuba, what's been interesting in the last year is criticism is more and more overt. Online criticism and people with great who have substantial prominence in the artistic community, intellectual community, writing things. There's a guy named Carlos Alzugaray, who is a former ambassador to the European Union, has lectured in U.S. universities, was a visiting professor in the U.S., well known among Cuban experts. Alzugaray wrote a long article for La Joven Cuba. La Joven Cuba, the editor of it is in the U.S. right now, but it's a really excellent publication which raises fundamental questions about what reforms are necessary. It's in Spanish, but you can always Google a translation into English. So if people are reading anything, I'd say they should get La Joven Cuba and follow that if they want to know what the current ferment is among Cuban intellectuals and activists who are not, they're not anti-revolutionary, except they're anti the collapse of the revolution and the collapse of its aspirations. But it's not that they want it to move to the left, it's that they want it to open to popular reaction and a more democratic system. There's also John Kavalich, who is a business person who was at one point very close to the Cubans and then had a falling out, publishes something called Economic Eye on Cuba, which is a very good source of he's one of the people that argues that there is a deal in the process being made. So people should look at that as well as the mass media accounts, which tend to the nothing is going to change and things are going to get worse and worse. And their sort of premise and hope that it will all collapse and somehow there will be a regime change, which would be a disaster for everybody.
John, thank you very much for being with us today. I really, really appreciate it. And I will hopefully we'll hopefully have you back in the not too distant future. So thanks again, John. And that was John McAuliffe, who's been working with normalizing relationships with Cuba for the last 30 years. And we reached a point now where who knows what's going to happen. So I'm really glad that John came on today, and I hope you enjoyed the interview. And, David, I'd like to have you put that song back on that I was playing a little while ago. Life is Just a Dance.
Could join the dance. It won't be easy, but it can be fun. Why don't we give it a chance? Say yes, say yes, say yes. Ah, yes, say yes, say yes. Yes, yes, yes. Life is a dance, any way you look at it, all of our life is a dance. Choose your own partner and pick the best song. Come now and join the dance. I know that life is a dance. Taking what comes and giving your all. There are rewards for this. And what I become is in my command. I am whatever I wish. Say yes, say yes, say yes. I am, say yes, say yes. Yes, yes, yes. Life is a dance, any way you look at it, all of our life is a dance. Choose your own partner and pick the best song. Come now and join the dance. I know that life is a dance. This dance, we have the lead when we follow our heart. May I have this dance, be the dancer, that's who you are. Say yes.
Yes, that was Carl Anthony with Life Is But a Dance. And, of course, you're listening to your own community radio station right here, WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And this has been the Peace and Justice Report. I'll be back in 2 weeks. Tom Walker will be back next week. And I know Tom had a great guest last Wednesday that you can hear on the archive. You can pull up any and all shows on the archive, the public affairs shows for up to 7 weeks and the music shows up to 2 weeks. But I have to recommend one that I listened to just yesterday. I always find the guest that Ralph Nader has on his show exceptional. Ralph covers all the current issues that we're dealing with. So I would highly recommend listening to his show last night on the archive, as well as last week. That's the one I was listening to yesterday, his show from last week, talking about corporations and how corporations are more or less dictating to the government what they want, what they need, and they get anything and everything they want. But he was talking to someone who's an expert on the Internal Revenue Service and how the corporations, as we all know, hardly pay any taxes whatsoever. So tune into that one. Tune into any and all shows on the archive. So thank you very much for being with us, and I'll be back in